In the adventure world, there's no end state. You don't know when you're going to finish. The climate is changing all the time. The rules, there is no rules. You've got to keep pushing forward. And that's why I think you always have to remember not what you're doing, but why you're doing it. And I think if you remember your why, that can become very powerful in life. When things get tough, when you want to give up and you've had enough, think about what's the reason why I started this journey in the first place? And that reason has to be strong enough to make you want to push through those storms, to make you get out of bed in the morning and to keep fighting for that goal. It's only when you're being tested that you can really find out, I feel, what you're made of deep down when all said and done.
Welcome to Salish Wolf, a podcast bringing you inspirational stories of extraordinary endeavors. I am your host, Todd Howard. Just south of my Vancouver Island home is a tiny archipelago on which for nearly a decade lived a most astonishing animal, a lone wolf. Takea, as he would be named, survived and thrived in an environment where likely no wolf had ever set foot. In the process, he captured the hearts of a community and showed us even the most unlikely is possible. His story is not dissimilar to those of the individuals interviewed on this podcast. At some point, they each had to turn to their inner lone wolf. From there, they were able to lead and inspire. My intention is to share their journeys to help you discover your own inner greatness and peace. This podcast is brought to you by Anchor Point Expeditions, where I provide life-changing personal leadership retreats for men, coaching, and other valuable personal growth resources. Visit anchorpointexpeditions.com to see where your journey could take you. Jordan Wiley is not good at one thing in particular, being idle. This man does life-threatening adventure like most people go to the store. When COVID restrictions put a halt to his attempt to run 10 marathons in the 10 coldest places on the planet, Jordan rapidly switched plans to attempt to circumnavigate the United Kingdom on a stand-up paddleboard. To add to the extreme level of difficulty in this quest, Jordan had to first learn to paddleboard in less than 7 days. What may seem like pursuits of madness, for Jordan are in reality pursuits of purpose. He does not focus as much on how he is going to accomplish something as he does on why he is going to accomplish something. His why for his sea voyage was a little boy in Africa who he had promised to build a school for. So his fundraising paddleboard expedition was to him not a choice, but a duty. While England was in lockdown, Jordan took to the seas. Despite superhuman credentials, Jordan humbly makes it clear that he is not resistant to suffering and struggles. He details his harrowing experience with divorce that eventually led him to contemplate his final journey from a skyscraper in Dubai. The man who had once climbed Kilimanjaro barefoot and had fought off Somali pirates had nearly lost both his why and his will. With renewed determination, he is now trying to remove the stigma of mental illness and also to provide education for children who have few options. In my opinion, Jordan is superhero-like, and he is also remarkably human, in ways that enable him to change lives. His newest book, The Power of the Paddle, is an account of his world record-breaking paddleboard journey and will be released this fall. Be prepared to be deeply moved in this episode of Salish Wolf with Jordan Wiley. Salish Wolf episodes highlight the power of the human spirit, the ultimate testing ground of which seems to be adversity. The hardships that make us human, remarkable humans, often involve trauma and grief. As isolating and crippling as they can be, you are not alone in your journey with them, and you do not have to be alone in your journey through them. My wife, Bree Sager, is a certified grief recovery specialist and provides online, group-based programs for individuals ready to explore their healing potential. Grief is emotional, not logical, and she uses her intuition, training, and experience to guide you into your heart to find true healing. This work with her is deeply transformative and profoundly liberating. To learn more, visit beyondgrief.ca/individuals. Her next multi-week programs begin in the first half of September and are extremely limited in spaces. Pause for a moment, tune into your heart, and listen if this opportunity feels right. If it does, apply to the Beyond Grief Grief Recovery Program and take the next step in your healing journey. And now, on with the show. Jordan, welcome to Salish Wolf.
No, thank you very much for inviting me along.
Oh, it's an honor to have you here. It's a very quick turnaround on our our planning here. I wasn't expecting to do this on such short notice, but I'm really happy to have this chance to sit down with you.
Yeah, sometimes opportunities just come along and you've got to grab them in life, haven't you?
Oh, that's right. So I know we're on limited time, so I just want to jump right in. Tell me about the book, The Power of the Paddle, that is coming out soon.
Yeah, so a new book coming out it's not coming out till November, so a few months away yet, but I've wrote quite a few books now, and this is probably my, I guess every time a new book comes out, an author would always say it's my best work yet.
I'm sure it is.
But now this one I'm really proud of, because it's, although it's called The Power of the Paddle, it's actually about a promise that I made to a little boy on the Horn of Africa about three years ago or so. And we sort of document and illustrate the adventures and the extreme challenges that I took on to raise enough funds to build a school on the Horn of Africa for this little boy and his friends who were displaced by the conflict in Somalia, and they made their way north to Djibouti. So I took on lots of different challenges over the last 3 years or so, and they've all been to try and build a school. And I'm now delighted to say that we've built that school. I just came back from Africa about 5 or 6 weeks ago, having opened the school. So to go from a bit of grubby old wasteland to now seeing a school for 250 children is incredible. But The Power of the Paddle it illustrates that journey. And one of the main adventures that I took on was I attempted to paddleboard, stand up paddleboard around Great Britain last year in the middle of the pandemic. So I lived on the ocean for most of last year while everybody was sort of living in their homes. I tried to paddle around Great Britain, and unfortunately I was stopped when I got to the top of Scotland. So I set a new world record at the time for the longest ocean paddleboard journey. I spent 149 days consecutively on my board.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, paddled for 2,377 kilometres. But unfortunately, the government in Scotland, they sent me packing home on Christmas Eve 2020, because new regulations came in that meant nobody can literally move anywhere. We were in a complete sort of lockdown across Great Britain. So I didn't get to finish paddling. But I guess the message in the book is that it doesn't matter what you do in life. It's about why you do it. You know, it's about what is your purpose. And my purpose was to deliver on a promise. So I don't have any regrets or any sort of, you know, negative outlooks on not being able to finish it, because my mission was accomplished. I raised over 100,000 British pounds, which allowed me to go and finish building the school. Now, you know, a lot of people go, oh, no, it's no good. But actually, it was amazing. And the bonus was I got to go home for Christmas with my daughter and my family. So every cloud has a silver lining, as they say.
Absolutely. Oh, that's incredible, man. I'm so happy to hear that you got to do that and that it succeeded in the sense of raising money for the school. And what an accomplishment, creating something.
It's my greatest achievement, I think, in life, to deliver that school. And you know, it was not an easy journey. It was very stressful. It was, you know, lots of trips to Africa. You can imagine in some of these countries, there's a lot of issues with things like corruption and, you know, getting permissions from tribal leaders, from politicians. And it was a minefield in itself. But I think in life, as long as you persevere and you don't give up, you always get there in the end. You know, I think the only time you ever fail in life is when you decide to give up. And sometimes things can take a lot longer. Sometimes there'll be obstacles and challenges along the way. But as long as you keep on moving forward and you keep attacking every day, you know, you'll get to whatever your goal is. And I think that's the same, not just in adventure, which is what I do, but in business, in life, in love. As long as you always hang in there, you know, you can make progress, I think.
Yeah. Why the school? Why was that the mission, to create the school, and why there?
So, you know, when I was, if I take you back to my childhood, I was quite, I don't know what you would call them in on the other side of the pond, but I was quite a naughty little boy, if you like, and that's not something I'm proud of, but I didn't take the opportunities that I had when I was a teenager. You know, I went to school like most people, but I didn't really respect, you know, the school or the teachers, and I was often in trouble. And my escape was always the great outdoors. You know, I loved to be climbing trees, to be fishing, to be, you know, camping out overnight. But I didn't like education. It just didn't work for me. And I think what I learned, because I joined the military at 16 years old, and I was serving, you know, by 19 years old, 18, 19. I was on combat operations in Iraq, and I got to see firsthand the challenges that children at the other side of the world go through. And actually, I realized when I was out there in the Middle East that actually to go to school is a great privilege. And then I remember thinking back and reflecting to my childhood, thinking that even though my childhood wasn't amazing, even though I came from quite a rough area, a rough background, actually, I still had a lot of opportunities and a lot of opportunities that a lot of children would never have in the world. And when you see children in places like, you know, Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever it might be, you see that actually in the West, we're very privileged to a lot of children in the world. You know, even today, I do a lot of research on this. And even today there, every day we've seen around average of 300 children killed in conflict and war zones around the world. More than one third of children in the world will never go to primary school. And it made me realize that we're very blessed actually. And I always made a promise when I was a soldier that if I could ever come back to these places, I would love to come back and try and inspire a bit of hope for a better future with the gift of education. So for the last 10 years or so, I've been traveling to places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Libya, Syria, and I try and do my best to help young people in those countries. And you know, I'm not naive enough to think that I can change the world, but what I have learned is that I can change the world for a handful of kids out there. And I think if you can make a difference in life, then you should always try and make a difference at whatever it is that you're passionate about.
Awesome. And you changing the world for a handful of kids, that is changing the world.
Well, absolutely. These children would have never gone to school, you know, and we're building a school. And hopefully from that, they can take some hope and inspiration. And, you know, maybe it won't work for everybody, but certainly we're giving people a chance in life. And I think that's what people need. Young people need opportunities. They need opportunities to grow, to learn, to evolve. And, you know, I always find, you know, that when I speak even in the UK to like schools and colleges and things, that a lot of people have given up on their dreams before they've even started. And you know what? I think the problem often is adults. Adults are the problem in the world because they haven't achieved some of their goals. So they convince the next generation that they can't achieve their goals or their aspirations. So I think we live in a world today which is dominated by celebrity culture, by social media, and we've got a lot of uninspiring people and messages in the world, and we need people adding more positive energy to the next generation. And I'm not saying that that's all I do, but I try and contribute to try and give in the next generation some inspiration, hopefully, and some hope. And I try my best to provide opportunities for them in any way I can.
Yeah. Well, I think even if each of us just helped one other person, we would be changing the world. And really, even if we each just helped ourselves, and if everyone took the time to grow, it's going to be a better world.
Thank you so much. If we just give a little bit, we can do so much together.
Yeah. Oh, good for you, man. So with that celebrity status that you're talking about, how do you, now that you have two very well-known books out there, a third one on the way, how do you kind of reckon with your rising status as far as being a known figure, a bit of a celebrity yourself?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if I consider myself a celebrity, but I think if you have a profile of public interest of any sort, I think that for me, it comes with responsibility and accountability. I think if you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of followers who want to take an interest in your life, I think that has to come with an accountability. I think you have to think about before you push out tweets or Facebook posts or Instagram pictures. I think I take that responsibility very seriously. I think, is it inspiring? Is it encouraging? Is it educational? Is it motivational? Or am I just adding more negative energy to the world? And I think that if you have a following of a public profile, that has to come with responsibility. And I don't think it does at the moment for the world. And I think that's one of the problems and challenges because, you know, your big influencers and celebrities of today, they have more influence than mainstream politicians, than business leaders, you know, just through their followership. So it's quite scary and it can be quite damaging. And all I can do is make sure that what I push out there on my platforms is hopefully adding something positive to the world. And hopefully if enough of us do that, then the world will be a more positive place, I guess.
Yeah. Where did stand-up paddleboarding come into things for you?
So stand-up paddleboarding actually was very new to me about 12 months ago. It was...
Really?
Yeah. I'd never stand-up paddleboarded on the ocean until exactly probably about 13 months ago, before I set off to try and paddle around Great Britain.
That's insane.
The reason I attempted to do that was because I was actually doing another challenge, which was 10 marathons in the 10 coldest places in the world. And while I was doing that, COVID came along and destroyed all my travel plans. So I needed a new fundraising plan closer to home. I was doing these 10 marathons, and actually I was in Canada for my first one. I was doing the Yukon Arctic Marathon up in near Whitehorse in the Yukon Territories, which was amazing. One of the most spectacular places I've ever been, and I'll definitely go back there to one day. I hope to paddle the Yukon River, you know, in the next year or two maybe. But I did the Yukon, I did Alaska while I was over there, and then I flew to Siberia, and then I went to Iceland, and I was actually going to the North Pole to do marathon number 5. And this was in like March, April 2020, and then COVID struck the world. So they sent me back home and said, you got to stay at home and you're not allowed to leave the UK now. So I'm racking my brains, getting stressed like everybody else was. I was like, what can I do that will keep me in the UK, but will also allow me to be socially distanced where I'm not going to infect anybody or anything? So I thought, well, I'm going to stand on this little piece of sort of, you know, carbon fiber in the middle of the ocean, about the size of an ironing board, and I'm going to try and paddle around the whole of Great Britain. And that's what I did. I tried to.
So how much training did you do before you set off on this trip?
Well, from taking on the idea of it to actually leaving for day one was 7 days. So I had 5 or 6 days training. And, you know, and that was probably a reflection of why I spent the first 2 weeks more in the water than I was on the board, you know, learning the hard way while I was paddling. I spent a lot of time in the water in that first week or two. It was horrendous. And there was many times when I thought, what the hell am I doing here? This is going to take a lifetime to get around.
Did you have anyone with you, a support crew?
Yeah, so we started with a support boat, and that lasted 3 days till the engine blew up, and then we went to a support vehicle. So I had a guy on land who was sort of trailing me down the coastline, and then when we had to cross to Ireland across the Irish Sea, we got another support boat. But I think I paddled about 60-65 days without a support boat, and then the next sort of 90 days I had a support boat, which was cool.
Did you have any lessons before you set off? Or were you learning
the paddle? Yeah, I had a couple of days of lessons to sort of, you know, try and master the technique. And I think the instructor, he thought, what are you doing? You've got no chance. You can't even stand on this thing. You know, he was looking at me like I was absolutely crazy. I don't think he took me seriously. And you know, but as I was saying earlier, as long as you keep going at whatever it is in life, you get there in the end. And it's like riding a bike when you're a kid. You know, when you're a little child, you get on the bike, you fall off, you know, maybe 20, 30, 100 times. And eventually something clicks and you start moving and you start staying on and going in the right direction. And I think that's the same with any activity or any sport or any new challenge that you want to take on. You got to sometimes learn the hard way. But what else was I going to do? Everyone was locked down in COVID, sat in their bedrooms, and weren't allowed to leave their house. So it was as good a time as any to learn a new skill.
Wow. I want to learn a little bit more about the physical challenge in this before and then I want to learn about the psychological aspect of it. But so when you set off on this, what kind of gear were you bringing with you?
At the start, you know, the most important thing when you're taking on an adventure for me is always the safety aspect. I think everything always starts with, you know, like a risk assessment. So for me, as long as I was safe, you know, we could sort of work the rest out as we were going along in terms of kit and equipment and whatever else I needed nutritionally. And, you know, I had lots of trackers on me because it was a world record attempt, and radios, flares, so many bits of kit. But in terms of what I was wearing, you know, it was in the middle of the British summertime when I set off. So I was pretty much in a shorts and T-shirt. And as we progressed, then I went into like a neoprene two-piece wetsuit, and then I went into a full wetsuit, and as we got to the top of Scotland, I was in a full dry suit. I was just adapting to my environment all the way around, really. And you know, as I learn, nature dictates everything that you do when you're on the ocean in the great outdoors. You know, it's the wind, it's the tide, it's the weather that you're at the helm of whatever that says you've got to do. Sometimes it would not allow you to paddle because You know, you can't paddle against the wind. You know, a strong wind is going to push you backwards. You're like a sail in the ocean, you know, stood on a paddleboard, you know, upright. I'm 6'3", so I'm quite tall. So I'm like a big sail. If the wind's going the wrong way, it's just pushing me backwards.
Mm. Did you start on the Channel side or on the Atlantic side?
I started in a place called Essex, which is right in the bottom right-hand corner of Great Britain. And then I paddled from Essex all the way along the south coast to the most southerly tip of England, which is called Land's End. And then I turned back on myself and paddled up. And as I got to North Devon, which is a big county in England, I then paddled to Wales, which is another country. And then from Wales, I paddled to Ireland, which is another country. And then I paddled up the Irish coast to Northern Ireland, which is another country, and then I paddled into Scotland. So we paddled five countries. I saw, you know, over 100 dolphins. I saw seals. I saw one shark. I saw amazing wildlife. That the nature aspect was probably one of the biggest highlights.
And how was the ocean? How did it treat you? Are you a surfer by nature? Did you have any?
I'm not
experience?
A surfer. No, definitely not a surfer either. I remember doing a news interview at the time, and I remember describing it as being beautifully brutal. You know, some days were just majestic. When the water was nice and calm, it was tranquil, it was peaceful, it was good for your mental health and well-being. But then some days, you know, you were against the biggest waves that you had ever experienced. I was fighting oceans that the fishermen wouldn't even take their boats out in. Every day was a new challenge. It was, you know, no 2 days were ever the same throughout the whole expedition. You know, 149 days, we experienced everything that the Atlantic had to throw at us, I think.
And now, were you coming on land to sleep at night?
So for the first 66 days, I was pulling up onto a beach every night. And, you know, sometimes I'd sleep on the beach in a tent. Sometimes I'd be in a van. Sometimes somebody would give me a back garden or a spare bedroom. And that was actually a real highlight of the adventure, not having a support boat, because every day I would be staying with, you know, different families and people would come and help me out or bring a barbecue to the beach. But of course, when we got into like Scotland and places like that, there is nobody around for like weeks. It's like, you know, derelict remote area. So that was when we had a support boat, because we lived on the support boat then.
Dude, that's incredible. All right. So tell me about the psychological journey. Because this is not a small feat to undertake. And as you said, every day brings about new challenges and new glories, but those challenges are massive.
Yeah, I think, you know, if I'm honest, I think the psychological battle was probably, in fact, I know it was much tougher than the physical battle. You know, even though we were paddling sometimes for 12, 15, 16, 17 hours a day, it was the psychology aspect that really I found challenging, because some days you wouldn't be able to paddle because the wind or the tide was against you all day. So you physically couldn't make progress. So, you know, when it was winter time in places like Scotland, and you're just sat there for days, over a week sometimes, waiting for a weather window, not knowing, you know, when the next weather window is going to come, it was so frustrating and so challenging. And then I was working actually with a lovely lady called Paula Reed, who is known around the world as the adventure psychologist. She's an extreme adventurer, but is also a psychologist by trade. And she specializes in this very niche field of adventure psychology. And adventure psychology is really interesting, because it's very different than sports psychology. And the reason it's different is because if you think of a sport, you think, you know, you've got a fixed environment, whether that's, you know, a playing field or a track or whatever it might be. You have a fixed set of rules that you have to abide to. It's normally in a safe arena or whatever it might be. Whereas in the adventure world, there's no end state. You know, you don't know when you're going to finish. You know, the climate is changing all the time. The rules, there is no rules. You know, you've got to keep pushing forward. And so I worked with an adventure psychologist, and she gave me so many valuable tools in my toolbox, in my brain, that I could use when things weren't going well. Just things like, you know, one of the things that I learned was how important statistics and data was to me. You know, when you're on such an enduring expedition, you know, you want to know things like how many calories are you burning, how far away to the next port or harbor, how far is that headland in the distance, you know, how much wind or tide is going to be against us, how many knots, and all these little snippets of data that you're sort of processing all the time that's being fed to you. It became so important for morale, you know, to manage. And You know, on the days when I was really frustrated because I couldn't paddle, instantly I felt very negative because I knew that the world record clock was ticking away and I wasn't making progress. So I felt very negative. But then I would start thinking about how do I reframe these negative thoughts into positive or neutral ones? And what I would do is I would focus on things like, well, now I'm not paddling. I can let my body recover. I can get a good meal inside me. I can speak to my daughter on the phone. So I was able to turn these negative thoughts about not paddling into actually quite positive things just by simply taking that hat off and taking a different perspective on things. And I found that a very valuable tool on such an enduring project. It was a real battle. And obviously at the end, we got stopped early. We got stopped after, you know, at the top of Scotland. And it would have been very easy to be very negative. A lot of people said, oh, that's, you know, the first question that the interviewers and the journalists want to ask is, you must be devastated because you got stopped after 5 months of paddling before you got to the end. But actually, no, I wasn't, because my mission was to build a school. So we built a school. And that's why I think you always have to remember not what you're doing, but why you're doing it. And from a psychological perspective, every time I wanted to give up, you know, I thought about those little faces of those children who wanted to go to school in Africa. I think about that promise that I'd made to that little boy to make sure that we could build that school. And I think if you remember your why, that can become very powerful in life, not just in adventure, but in any aspects of your life. You know, when things get tough, when you want to give up and you've had enough, think about what's the reason why I started this journey in the first place? What's the reason? You know, and that reason has to be strong enough to make you want to push through those storms, to make you get out of bed in the morning and to keep fighting for that goal or that objective, whatever it is.
And so was that school what anchored you in your mission, kept you going every day, even on those days you wanted to give up?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. That was at the forefront of my mind every day. You know, you made a promise to a little boy who will never have the life that I have and never have the experience that I've come to know. So, you know, and actually, do you know, the fact that everyone was locked down with the COVID pandemic, that actually helped me a lot, because I used to sometimes feel when I was younger, if I was away or in the military on operations, I always used to have that fear of missing out on something. And because everybody was locked in their homes in the pandemic, I reframed that as, I'm the only person in the UK who's on an adventure. I'm the only person who is living at sea. And I've got this amazing adventure that I'm on. So I took that negative COVID thought and thought, I'm lucky. I'm actually blessed to be doing this. And one of the things that I learned was, you know, I did feel under a lot of pressure because I promised the charity we'd raise over 100,000. I promised these children we'd build a school. I promised my sponsors lots of media exposure. So one of the things that the pressure became quite consuming. And one of the things that I learned when I was out there is that actually you can reframe pressure, and actually pressure can become a privilege. So instead of thinking pressure is a negative thing, think of it as that you're a privileged position and that's why you're under pressure. And that's the same advice that I would share with a business CEO or a leader of an organization. You know, there's a reason why you've been picked to lead these troops or this company or to be out there on expedition. So it's actually a privilege. It's not a great pressure. It's a privilege that you've earned. And that was my psychological way of reframing pressure.
That's brilliant. It sounds like an expedition that had been planned over months and months, if not years. You had about 7 days. How did you get all of this stuff lined up, from the adventure psychologist to the media to the sponsors? Were you doing this as you were paddling? Did you have people who were working on this?
Literally. I think one of the things in life that you learn, or what I've learned as I've got older, is sometimes you've just got to go and do it, because you sit around thinking about these things and you end up overthinking them and talking yourself out of them. And I speak to people every day, friends, family, and they're always like, I want to do this one day. I want to go there. And I'm like, well, just go and do it, because, you know, before long, it's going to be too late. I speak to people every day and they tell me about what they're going to do when they retire. And I'm like, you're going to be dead a few years after you retire. Let's live life now. You know, let's think about what we do between 16 and 65, not let's start living when we're 65. You know, we need to live with adventure and that spirit in us every day now. And I just said, I'm going to do this. And I got up and did it. And as I said at the start, as long as you're safe, the rest you can work out as you're going along. And fortunately, I had lots of amazing people who wanted to help me, lots of amazing team members who wanted to reach out and support me. And that's one of the great things about social media. You know, I have a lot of negative things to say about social media, but one of the great positive things is you can round up the troops and you can build communities very quickly and spread messages, hopefully positive ones, you know, using social media tools.
Did you go out and buy all of your equipment, or did you go out and find sponsors to deliver in?
Oh, I never spent a penny. Everybody okay. sponsored every bit of kit. Even the 40-foot support yacht was sponsored to us by.
Really?
We never. And everyone. The amazing thing was everybody who was in the team, from the filmmaker, the cameras, the support boat captain to the adventure psychologist, they were all volunteers. And I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, surrounding yourself with like-minded people, surrounding yourself with people who have the same values, who have the same vision. I think when people are trying to build teams, they often look for the most talented or the best. But actually, I think it's about who are the most loyal, who are the most committed, who are the share the same values and vision. I think if you have those sort of traits, then, you know, you're unstoppable, I think.
You must have had a million things to organize all the way through this week-long prep period. Why did you leave at the moment you left, knowing that you still had all these things that were all these loose ends? Was it just a timeline you put yourself on? I'm going to go on this day and that's that?
Well, there was a timeline, but mainly the timeline was because we were already coming to, you know, the middle end of summer. So the longer I left it was, I was going into winter, and I was going into the, you know, as I found out in November, December, you know, you don't want to be paddling around Scotland. You know, when you're off the top of Scotland, you know, you're closer to the Arctic Circle than you are London. You know, it was, you know, sub-zero temperatures. We're waking up with ice and snow on the board. You know, it's not conducive to productive paddling.
No. What was the hardest day or hardest moment?
You know, there was lots of highs and lows. I think crossing the Irish Sea the first time, because I obviously had to cross the Irish Sea twice to get to Ireland and then to go up Ireland and then into Scotland. And I think crossing the Irish Sea, it took me like 4 days to cross the sea, because it kept chewing me up and spitting me back out and sending me back to Wales. And that was very, very frustrating, very sort of demoralizing. So I think physically that was probably, you know, the toughest challenge. Of course, coming to the end of it was very tough as well. You know, after you'd give your heart, your soul, and all your teammates would give everything as well, to be then told that's the end of it. You know, that was tough. Although we reframed it and we were able to take so many positives from it. You know, I'd be lying if I said it wasn't, you know, disappointing to some degree.
Yeah. What was the highlight, if you can pick one of the most magnificent moments?
I think, you know, paddling alongside dolphins every day, big pods of dolphins literally paddling with you all day and swimming next to you. If dolphins don't make you smile and happy, then, you know, you may as well give up, because it's very special. I think the nature, you know, experiencing and being immersed in nature for 5 months every day. And also the people, you know, I met so many amazing people. I think there's something very special about those people that live in coastal communities. They've got a real adventurous spirit. They've got big, warm hearts, and they just want to help. You know, the amount of people that I met that wanted to give me a warm meal or a warm bed for the night in a spare room, or just bring me a hot chocolate on a beach off the top of Scotland or whatever it might be. Just amazing generosity. It really restored my faith in humanity. So many good people out there in the world who wanted to make a difference.
Mm. How are your hands? I noticed you had a blackfish paddle. Were you paddling blackfish paddles the whole way?
Yeah, blackfish paddles the whole way, yeah. Blackfish very kindly sponsored me. And it was an amazing, you know, when I started this, I obviously didn't know that much about paddling at all, as you know, but I was very fortunate to work with the Blackfish team, because their paddle was incredible. It was, you know, it's a bit like a soldier, you know, you want to make sure that your weapon works before you go to battle. And I think I was very lucky to have been linked in with Blackfish, because it was, their paddles were incredible. And since then, you know, when I've been out with friends and things, I've seen the paddles they use, and they don't come close to the Blackfish. Amazing piece of kit.
How did your hands hold up? They must have just been raw meat after a while.
It was, you know, lots of obviously calluses and things, but I had like this claw hand for like, after when I finished the paddling, my hand was like this, and I couldn't even like open the fingers, you know. It was, sorry, I know this is audio, I'm showing you a video here. I had this this like claw hand where I couldn't stretch it, and then I got these like little, you know, climbers often get this as well when they're climbing, and I got these like rubber rings that go around your fingers, and you have to like stretch your hands out and your fingers, and you have to, you know, I was doing it all day and night, and eventually they give way and your hand opens up again. But it was, It's quite frustrating because you can't even eat or drink or anything properly. It's very strange.
Did you have any physical near breaking points? Like, was there any part of your body that became the weak link and became very problematic?
I had an incident on the south coast of England very early on where it was in the summer of the UK, and we had some naughty jet skiers who were drunk, and they were flipping paddleboarders off their boards, and very stupid behavior. Yeah, it was crazy, and they'd been doing it all day, as the lifeguards told me. And yeah, this guy flipped me off my board, and I hit what we call a groin in the sea, and I got it really like. Caused my leg real problems. I got something called cellulitis because it got infected where the cuts were, and it went on for about 5 or 6 weeks. So I had a few trips to the hospital in between. But I think, and then when I was in the north of Scotland, I had a real stomach pain, and since then I've become one of these gluten-free people because I realized it was a wheat intolerance, as we found out when I got back. But I had this stomach pain for like 2 months, and I went and did like MRI scans and tried to find out what was wrong with me. And what we realized was I was eating, I don't know if you have them in Canada, but we have a cereal called Weetabix over here.
Yeah, I know of it. Yeah.
Yeah, we have Weetabix, and I was eating like 10 Weetabix a day sometimes. And I thought I thought it was like the safest thing to eat because I was trying to avoid anything else. But actually it was the overeating of all this wheat that's given me an intolerance to it, apparently. So
oh, crazy.
Yeah, now I'm a gluten-free person.
What board were you riding?
I was using an SIC Okeanos, which is like an ocean touring board, which again, when I first got on it, it was, I couldn't stand on it at all. The width of it was 28. That was like so narrow to what I'd see, even though that's not really that narrow in the racing world. For me, it was like super, super narrow.
Yeah, well, it is not in the racing world, but yeah, that's a pretty narrow board, especially to be learning on.
Yeah. Well, I'd only ever been on like one inflatable, which was like a 34. So it was like such a big difference. And yeah, when I remember standing on it for the first time, and it was just like, I could have been in a circus. You know, I was like dancing around, lasted about 5 seconds, and I was in the water because it was absolutely ridiculous. And the instructor must have thought, what is this doing?
Was it a 14.6 in length?
It was an amazing board as well, actually. Not that I ever mastered it, but when I became, you know, proficient and things, it was an incredible board. And actually it took so many knocks and grazes, you know, trying to clamber across rock lines and cliffs, and it just got battered every day, especially for those last few months around Scotland. And it served me so well. And actually at the end of the expedition, we auctioned it off for a children's charity, and it actually sits in a lovely office in the UK in a business that's sponsored, and it's hanging from the roof, this paddleboard, which is amazing.
Oh, very cool. So there were days you had to like portage over land. You couldn't go around certain points. Is that?
Well, no, we didn't portage, but depending on where I finished my paddle that day, it would be like on a beach, and maybe there wouldn't be. When you get into Scotland, it's just super high cliffs all around the coastline. So it was actually quite risky sometimes, because we always had to try and plan where my entry and exit points would be. And sometimes you would have to paddle against the tide and the wind for an extra, you know, 5 or 10 kilometers just to get to somewhere where you can get out of the water physically, because there was no beaches or whatever it might be.
Crazy. What an adventure, man. Good for you. I know I don't want to take up all of our time talking about this, because adventure is just kind of in your blood. Like, you've been doing crazy things for a long, long time. How did that come about? Like, I read that you climbed Kilimanjaro barefooted.
Yeah.
This quest to run 10 marathons in the 10 coldest places. Like, most people don't even want to go to the 10 coldest places or run a marathon. And yet, where did this come from?
No, I think, you know, like everybody in life, I've had lots of challenges. And I think for me, probably the turning point was I had a bit of a breakdown with my own mental health. I came out of a long-term relationship with the woman who's the mother of my daughter. We were together like, you know, over 10 years, and I've got an 11-year-old daughter now. And when that broke down, that relationship, which was a lot of my responsibility as well, I was working away from home all the time, you know, and I think I dare I say my moral compass slipped, and I forgot what really mattered in life. And this is going back like maybe 7-8 years now. And I think that, you know, I started to be sort of blinded by wanting to earn more money, wanting to drive a faster car, and wanting to climb the career ladder. And I actually neglected the thing that is the most important, which was my partner at the time and my daughter, because I was always loyal, I was always honest, but I was always like working away from home or overseas and things. And I never took the warning signs. And one day I came home to an empty home, and they decided that, you know, enough was enough. And that I really struggled to deal with that and accept that for about 2 years. And it took me to an incredibly low place. And I guess from there, you know, I used adventure and I used finding purpose through the charity stuff to I guess almost reinvent myself and to find that passion that I'd lost in life. I think when I left the military as well, after 10 years, I think that you lose your sense of identity. You know, when you're in the military and you're on, you know, you have your uniform, your medals, you serve your country. It's a very proud organization to be a part of. And then when you leave, it's sort of, you know, you're back on the sort of the scrap heap, so to speak. And I found it really difficult, that transition from the military to being a civilian. And I found it was through adventure, give me purpose in my life again. I was able to not only help people, but also learn more about myself. And, you know, I think when you put yourself in extreme environments, you know, whether that's cold or hot or at the ocean or, you know, in the polar regions, although it's very difficult, it's very uncomfortable, you actually learn more about yourself and you actually grow more as an individual than perhaps anywhere else in the world, because, you know, you're being tested to your limits. And it's only when you're being tested that you can really find out, I feel, what you're made of deep down when all said and done. And I find that's what adventure gives me. It allows me to grow, evolve, but also help people.
Dude, I got chills the whole time you were telling that story. It's something that I think probably everyone to an extent can relate to when
I think things just fall apart. Yeah, we all fall, you know, we all have challenges, we all have obstacles. And, you know, a lot of people think because you was in the military, it's always got to be related to conflict, but it wasn't for me. For me, it was the normal things in life. It was, you know, relationship, jobs, stress. It was the things that we all experience at some stage. But, you know, the most important thing I would say for me and for everybody is that you can't change the past. So you can't sit and dwell on it. And that's what I was doing for about 2 years. I was like, how did this all go wrong? How can I fix this? And, you know, at the time, my ex-partner, she moved on. She's actually one of my best friends now, her and a new partner. They have a new family. You know, they got a new daughter as well. And actually, I went and had dinner with them on Christmas Day in their home. I often go for a walk in the park with them. And when I was able to move forward and take the lessons of the past, I was able to grow and learn. Because, you know, although I have lots of regrets, I don't dwell on the past anymore. I use them as opportunities to learn and move forward. And when I was trying to dwell on the past, it just destroyed me internally. And I became, you know, in a very low place, a very negative place. And it was only by seeking help and speaking to people that I was able to get out of that hole. And, you know, and that's the first step. Anybody who's experiencing any mental health challenges, the first step is that you have to acknowledge that you've got a problem in the first place. You can't ignore it, because it will just keep chipping away at you till there's nothing left. So you know, you've got to acknowledge it and you've got to do something about it. And that could be the toughest bit, I think, the most difficult bit.
Was there a particular turning point or catalyst that helped take you from that, the lowest of the lows, that apathetic place of being stuck in the past and regret, to actually get a fight back in you, a fight for life?
You know, I was actually working in Dubai in the UAE at the time, and I found myself on top of one of the biggest buildings, sort of apartment blocks in Dubai. And I was contemplating my life at the time. And my mother rang me while I was on top of a building, actually. And she talked to me and reminded me about, you know, things like, not that I needed reminding, but my daughter, you know, I'm a father, I'm a dad, I'm a role model. And that was the time when I thought, you know what, I need to sort my shit out. Excuse my language, but I needed to sort my shit out. I needed to get a grip of myself. You know, and I sort of felt quite selfish that I got to this place, because, you know, my daughter is innocent in all this. You know, she needs somebody to be a good role model, to be a good dad. And that was the realization when I was on top of that building in Dubai that, you know, now's the time. And then I went back to the UK. I went into therapy for a year. I went to doctors. I still take medication today, actually. And, Even like 5 years later, I still take daily medication, a very small dosage of a drug called sertraline, which is an antidepressant. And actually, you know, when I'm not doing adventures, I go quite low again. I'm not as low as I was before, but you know, when I came back from the paddle, I'm like, what can I do next? I need something else. I need to be working towards something. My mind has to be busy. A lot of my friends and family, they'll say, Jordan, you never stop. You never slow down. And I think that's because it's part of my coping mechanism to keep being busy and keep working and having something to work towards. Otherwise, it's a slippery slope for me downhill.
Now, just for clarification, when you were on top of this building, were you contemplating jumping? Is that?
Yeah. I was ready to put myself into oblivion. Wow. I'd had enough. You know, this was the stage sort of when my former partner, I'd found out that she'd moved on. You know, she had a new boyfriend. They were together now. And, you know, and my daughter, you know, what I found the toughest thing to process, and probably still do today, if I'm completely honest, is to know that my daughter sleeps in a home where somebody else, who's another guy, who's not me, tucks her in bed and reads her a story at night. And I find that very difficult to comprehend. Now I understand it and I respect it. And actually, the guy's not a bad guy. He's a good role model in his own right. But I still find that very difficult that, you know, I only have her, you know, 2 or 3 days a week, and the other 3 or 4 days, whatever, she lives in a home with another guy who is the male dominant role model in her life. And I find that really difficult. And I guess a lot of, whether you're the single mother, father, or whatever it might be, that is really challenging for anyone, I think, because for me, it's not right, but I got to respect it.
It's got to be one of the hardest parts about having a breakup when there's children involved and having that exact scenario. I have so many friends who are going through that and have been. Yeah.
But at the same time, what I learned, again, at the same time, it's very easy to be very negative. And actually, if you're negative, that only has a negative impact on your child. You know, if you're going to stand there and argue with your ex-partner, if you're going to, you know, cause them dramas in life, whether it's financial, whether it's, you know, with homes and houses and whatever it might be, it's just a toxic cycle that none of you ever get out of. And then, you know, me and my former partner, we have a very, as I say, she's like I see her like one of my best friends. Maybe she doesn't say the same, but she's someone who I rely on, who I can talk to about anything. She's someone who will help me out when she can. And I like to think that I do all those things for her as well. And we have a very positive relationship. I would even consider her partner as a friend as well. He's someone who I could have a beer with in the pub. So when you let go of all that negative energy and you decide to move forward, then it's good for everybody. And I know that's a lot easier said than done, because it took me 2 years to get to that point.
Yeah. Would you have jumped if your mom hadn't phoned?
I don't know. I you know, that was my intention why I went up there. It's very difficult to say, but I certainly felt like that's what I wanted to do. I felt like I felt so much stress and pressure, and that for me, it was easier to not be alive. You know, I had this knot in my stomach for like months and weeks and months where I wanted to be sick. I couldn't hold a conversation even with work colleagues without breaking down into tears, you know, and I would have to walk out the room and just say, oh, I'm feeling ill and all. And I just could not function. And it went on for months. And I was in my home, I'm like a very tidy person, you know, everything's got to be, you know, lined up with all neat and everything like this. And you know, my wardrobes are immaculate, and my home became a real mess. There was like food on the side and plates unwashed, and I just became a horrible person, I feel. And I had this like victim mentality where I felt the world owes me something. And I see it a lot in society today. You know, the world doesn't owe anybody anything. You find yourself in a mess, it's normally because of decisions or choices that you've made, and you've got to start making different choices to get out of that mess. Unfortunately, that's how you solve these problems.
Yeah. Why did she phone you? Do you remember? Was there intuition or?
No, well, she had sensed there was a lot of exchanges between me and my former partner, you know, about, you know, and I think I was being quite selfish, because I was saying to my partner, I've had enough. I want out of this world. And I think my mum and my former partner were very close. So they, you know, I think my former partner had said something to her and said, you know, can you speak to Jordan? He's in a bad place or whatever. And then she called me from that.
Incredible. So with As you said, the adventure as a coping mechanism for you, how it's something how you need it, you need that escape. Do you ever think or sit still long enough to think that maybe you're just running from something and that the adventure is basically covering up something that you still need to deal with and face?
Oh, it's a good question. It's a good, very good question. I've never thought of it like that, to be honest, but I don't think so, because all my adventures, they have a very clear purpose. It's, you know, so for me, actually, it doesn't matter if I was in the North Pole or I was in my back garden camping out. It's not what I'm doing. It's the why I'm doing it. And the only reason why I go to quite extremes with my adventures is because that's what attracts the big donors and the sponsors for fundraising. You know, if I was just to go and do a walk in my local park every day for a month, I wouldn't attract that much sponsorship or fundraising. Whereas if you do something that is a world record or a world first, or it's something very extreme, you know, people, I had donations of like 50,000, 20,000, because, you know, people want to see somebody push the boundaries. So it's not about what I'm doing. It's about why I'm doing it. And for me, what I learned in this last 5, 6, 7 years is my purpose is to help young people. It's to help keep them on the right track, keep giving them, you know, guidance. You know, one of the roles that I hold in the UK is I'm the UK's national ambassador for Army cadets. You know, I have a lot of interaction with young teenagers who are going through a lot of challenges in their own lives. And we try and use our values and the spirit of adventure to give them some, you know, inspiration and hope in life.
How has your daughter impacted your life?
Oh, my greatest achievement, you know, my pride and joy. You know, the reason I get out of bed in the morning, you know, I couldn't even put into words. I think it's the greatest privilege in the world to be a parent. You know, it really is. And you know, the key, it's quite easy to be a parent, but to be a good parent, you know, it takes a lot of sacrifice and a lot of commitment. And for me, it's a role that as I say, it's a privilege. It's a role that I take with extreme pride and responsibility. You know, I try to make I want my daughter to grow up and think, I hope that whoever I meet one day has the same values of my father. You know, I try to teach her about respect, about honesty, loyalty, selfless commitment, courage, you know, a bit of discipline. I try to teach all the values that I've come to help me in life, and hope that she picks some of that up. But at the same time, you know, you got to let people fail and learn it their own way as well, you know. But I think that's where the spirit of adventure is really important, because it allows you to go and search and seek, you know, your own ways in life.
Yeah. So this podcast has really kind of taken on a life of its own, and I've ended up interviewing a lot of adventurers, such as yourself, and a lot of experts in psychedelics. I'm just wondering, have you considered or tried any sort of psychedelics as an alternative to antidepressants, to see if there's anything there?
No, I haven't. I have done one thing that I do almost daily as an alternative sort of therapy is wild swimming. I swim in local rivers. You know, I it's something that I found so good for mental health and well-being, that invigorating. I do a lot in the winter. I've done ice baths and things like that, and cold showers, and I found that as one of the best therapies for me. It makes me feel so alive. It, you know, it raises my endorphin levels and just get that real good feel good factor ready for the day. But you know, I've done a bit of hypnotherapy as well. It's not something one of the therapists that I worked with, they were also a hypnotherapist, and we've tried that. And actually that was something that I was very skeptical about, and it was something that really helped me a lot. They took me back to my childhood, back to my early days, and you know, we uncovered memories and things that I'd experienced that I wouldn't have even been able to remember by thinking of them. So that was, you know, I guess an alternative type of therapy that actually was very productive. But if you'd have asked me beforehand, I'd have said it was, you know, what wasting our time, what a load of rubbish. But actually it was something really powerful.
Yeah, very cool. So I think we only got about 6 minutes to go. Is that right?
Okay. I got to jump on a FaceTime for somebody else.
So now that the school is complete, that why is kind of, I guess, taken shape and is somewhat complete. What's the why now? I know you said you're doing some filming. What are you working on?
I work on in the UK, I work on a TV show called Hunted, which is, it's about, it's a reality TV show. And it's how the best way to describe it. It's like a big game of hide and seek, but across the whole of the UK. And what we do, we have a team of what we call hunters, not in the hunters that you would know in Canada, but hunters in the sense of we go hunting for fugitives, so people on the run. So we have a team of ex-military, ex-police, ex-intelligence specialists from law enforcement and what have you. And what we do on this show is they send 10 normal people from all parts of society, from teachers and bankers and, you know, whatever they might be. And they go on the run for 30 days. And our job is to use our skills and knowledge to go and find them. And we hack their emails, we hack their social media, we have access to all the CCTV in the country, we check their vehicles, we interrogate their family members for clues, and they have 30 days. And if they get to day 30, they win £100,000, and our job is to stop them and track them and arrest them, if you like, before they get there. So it's, we actually filmed it in America. We're on series 6 in the UK, so we've done 6 years of this, and we filmed it in America about 3 years ago in the US, but it did one series and it didn't take off. But in the UK, it's a really popular show and a great concept. But I guess it didn't work in the US because the US is so huge, and it was just ridiculous trying to cover, you know, we're like smaller than a state or something over it.
Well, that's crazy. Are there any ground rules for the people where they can just go however?
Oh, these people go anywhere. They're allowed anywhere in the UK, but only up to 1 mile offshore. So they can't leave the country. You know, they can go on like little islands and things, but they can't go overseas. They do all the silly things. You know, they go on their social media, or they make a phone call. They use a bank card, and we're tracking all their bank trails, you know, to see where the traces they're leaving. They do the most ridiculous things that you would never do. And they always get really cocky as well. You know, they think because they're 2 weeks on the run that they think the hunters can't catch them, and then they'll do something. And we've got like drones, we've got helicopters, we've got sniffer dogs, we have everything. You know, it's crazy.
Wow, that's kind of eerie. Yeah, wow. Very interesting. Has anyone escaped your capture for 30 days?
Because if you get to the end, you win £100,000, and we've had one or two who've got away with it, yeah.
Yeah, wow.
It's just a TV show. But for me, what's really cool is that's what gives me a bit of a public profile to be able to, you know, do some good in the world, whether it's inspire young people or, you know, do a talk or write a book or whatever it might be. It gives me a bit of a profile to try and help others.
Right. Very cool. Jordan, thank you so much for this and for all of the why that keeps you moving on, for all the great things that you're doing for others, and you are changing the world.
No, thank you for having me, Todd. It's a real privilege to speak to you. And it's only because of platforms like you, though, you know, the things that you're doing, you're giving people like me a platform to spread those messages and share these thoughts. So it's, you know, incredible what you're doing. So keep up the awesome work.
Thank you. And I've got to say, like, I do this because I love having the deep, meaningful conversations with people, because there's inspiration there for others. And I just got to thank you for the courage to share the things that you shared just in this, in the last 53 minutes. Like, we went pretty deep in 53 minutes, and thank you for the courage to open up and tell people about your hardships. Cause really that's what helps us all move forward, to know that we're not alone in our struggles.
No, absolutely. I think it's really important as well. It's, you know, when you've overcome adversity or you've gone through a challenge, I think it's important to share those lessons to try and help other people. And as you say, nobody's alone. There's always somebody out there who can, you know, talk to or just pick up the phone or have a chat with anybody. But that's the first step, is to acknowledge, you know, you can't solve a problem if you won't acknowledge that you've got a problem. So, but no, a real pleasure to talk to you, Todd. And as I say, it's awesome work what you're doing, and you're opening up discussions on, you know, really important subjects as well, which are often a lot of stigma is attached to.
Yeah. Well, thank you, sir. Where can people find more about you, and when does the book come out?
Yeah. So the book comes out in the 9th of November. And you can find more about me on my website, jordanwiley.org, or I'm on Instagram and Facebook and YouTube, and that is at Mr. Jordan Wiley. And yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for letting me on.
Oh, thank you, Jordan. Keep up the beautiful work. You're a wonderful man. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
No, cheers, Todd. Thank you, mate. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Salish Wolf with Jordan Wiley. To learn more about Jordan, visit his website at jordanwiley.org. That's J-O-R-D-A-N-W-Y-L-I-E.org. or check him out on Facebook and Instagram at Mr. Jordan Wiley, Mr. as MR. Don't forget to pre-order a copy of The Power of the Paddle, his forthcoming book, and check out his previous best-selling books, Running for My Life and Citadel. Please visit anchorpointexpeditions.com for information on my men's leadership retreats, men's groups, and personal development coaching. Stay tuned for the announcement of 2021 retreats, during which I take men on purpose-driven adventures along British Columbia's wild coast. My next bow carving retreats are taking shape as early as September, and men's groups are ongoing. This show was produced by me, Todd Howard, on Vancouver Island. Music was written and performed by Jason Kaus of the Darcys. Special thanks to Pacific Rim College for their ongoing contribution to the show. For episodes on holistic health and sustainability, please tune in to my other podcast, Pacific Rim College Radio, at pacificrimcollege.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give it a 5-star rating on whatever podcast app you are using and share it with your friends and family. If there is a guest you would like to recommend for the show, please email discover@anchorpointexpeditions.com. You have been listening to Salish Wolf. I am Todd Howard, signing off.